What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Hapness, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I am on the mission to find the magic ingredients that make workshops work. Today with me on the show is Jenny Teolin, and we speak about daring to facilitate. What does it take to dare to do things differently, to dare to facilitate differently, and to be different? So stay tuned. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, scroll down to the show notes to download my free one-page summary. And now, lean back and be surprised. Jenny, welcome to the show. Hello.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited about this conversation and to speak about dare to facilitate. And we had this amazing exploration call where we found so many parallels in the work we do and the mindset we share. So this is going to be a good one. Spoiler alert, dear audience. And we still start at the beginning. When did you start calling yourself a facilitator? And actually, do you?
That's a good question. I would say that I've kind of always seen facilitation more of as a skill than a role. But it was during the time at Hyper Island, I was delivering a master's degree. I was launching and programming a master's degree for Hyper Island. And all the campus days are extremely facilitated, or, you know, in my mind, creatively planned. You know, I never really facilitation. But it wasn't until I had an experience where halfway through one of the years, I got a phone call from one of my students who was CEO at this big recruitment firm. And she called me and she said, Jenny, I just want to warn you. It's like, warn me about what? She said, well, you're going to receive a letter from the cohort, from the class. Like, okay, well, we've gotten together and we've written a letter. It's going to land in your inbox. You know, please don't take it personally. It's for Hyper Island, but, you know, you are our contact. Okay. And I received this letter. And in the letter was basically very constructive, well-written feedback on the program, which I, of course, took extremely personally. Letter up. Anyway, this letter then went through everyone at Hyper Island. And it wasn't until I spoke to my co-lead, Max, who said, actually, when we started talking about it, and I was really upset, he said, he was just smiling. I'm like, why are you smiling? He's like, but Jenny, think about everything you know about group dynamics. You know, they're in the conflict stage now. All we have to do is just help them over the edge. And, you know, they're on their way. We're doing our job. And I was like, oh, God damn it. He's right. You know, this is a good thing. They've gotten to a point in their group dynamics that they could question. And after that, we did have big reflection circles. They got the chance to, you know, like we went through everything and we met them on some parts and some parts we didn't. But it was really during that period where I realized that it wasn't, you know, just creative planning my job. This was facilitation because I had to deal with not only supporting their group development, but, you know, also looking at, okay, like, how can we adjust this and what can we do sort of learning experience and design-wise? Long answer. But, yeah, I think that was the first time that I could, you know, say, yes, I'm a facilitator now.
And I love the anecdote. Thank you so much for sharing that, because it's so easy to get caught in this situation where then you become defensive or you try to find solutions instead of really understanding for what it is.
Exactly.
And yeah. And for me, this is now this big aha of, oh, that's a difference between a air quotes normal university, normal master degree and a facilitation.
For sure. And this was not a usual master's degree. This was very much, everything was project-based. It was, the whole thing was a calculated designed learning experience, which I, you know, was kind of just thrown into. You know, I hadn't had the experience to sort of that extent before. And as you said, you know, the privilege of also realizing what, you know, your presence and what you do affects the group, not just the curriculum, because that's one thing, you know, making sure you book the right speakers and everything. But in this instance, it was very much meeting and also deciding to meet their feedback on sort of good terms, which is very easily also, you know, not done. I was very upset in the beginning. I was like, I quit. But then my co-facilitator talked some sense into me.
Yeah, and that's a big part of being a facilitator, right? To embrace the feedback, to stand there, not immediately jump into solution mode or fixing or running away, following our instincts.
Unfortunately, you know, in this case, sharing feedback and feed forward and, you know, looking at the well of knowledge and everything, they are taught that in this process. So that letter was, you know, in hindsight, extremely well crafted compared to more traditional education where they're not taught how to actually work with you. Then it's more sort of, okay, how are you just going to solve this problem, not meet them in it? So yeah, but the first time I actually met someone who called themselves a facilitator was years before. And to be honest, I hadn't really seen or understood the connection until I experienced it myself.
Yeah, I can see that. And beautiful to teach or train a group to the point that they can state what they need and exactly. Work it out as a group. Yeah. And this discomfort that you describe is beautiful, I think, already jump to the topic of daring to facilitate, because facilitation in this sense or in this context is a daring profession. It's uncomfortable. It's vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
What did you have in mind when you first came up with the idea of Dare to Facilitate that now became a book?
Well, I think I've always had that sort of sense of jumping into the deep end as a personality, because, I mean, throughout my childhood, I jumped between countries with my diplomatic parents. You know, we never really lived anywhere longer than 3 years. And I think that's sort of an innate way of being for me to test and always sort of be exposed to new things. And, you know, also reflecting on, I started one of my first businesses in 2009. And the whole premise of that was to work on creative projects that I'd never done before, for connection, you know, with your community. And that was part of, you know, working a lot on, I was a designer and art director at the time, and working on big campaigns and projects. And every single client that I met, they just wanted to have the same thing. You know, they wanted that award-winning campaign that we did for their competitor. They're just like, we want that. It's like, no. We have to look at innovation. We have to look at creating something that we haven't done before. So I think, you know, innately, that's been part of my driving force. And when it comes to facilitation, it's also, since I design and deliver learning experiences, the facilitation necessary for those kind of projects somewhat need to be daring, because if you design and you expect your learners to, you know, adopt a prototyping mindset to test and try and experiment, you need to embody that as well. So the idea is more that it's just kind of like an open challenge to the facilitation community. Just like, you can dare to do things differently, you know, dare to adapt, dare to, you know, test new grounds. And also, I mean, on a meta level, I decided to create the book the way I have because I wanted to write a book that I hadn't read yet. Like, I didn't just want to write about stuff that I already know, because I find that extremely boring. So that's why I invited so many people to contribute, because I want to know how, you know, Daniel in Curaçao facilitates innovation. I want to know how Dietra in Atlanta does it. So I think that's where the sort of the collaborative dare is quite a fun thing to do.
I can so relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think our DNA in that sense is pretty much alike. Like, oh yeah, we can do it together. We can collaborate on that.
I mean, how fun isn't it when you design a new activity that you've never done before. It's like, this is going to like revolutionize. You've not tested it, so you don't know if it works. But if you have the learners on board with you,
yeah,
then it becomes what it becomes, and you learn from it and you improve it and all the rest. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think, so funny enough, when I deliver a workshop to a client nowadays that I sort of have done before already, I feel like a fraud. So usually everything that I do is tailor-made. And I wonder whether you have the same, that when I go there, I'm so excited to see whether it's going to work out as I planned it or not, that I think this excitement for the idea and the tailored preparation also vibrates and spills over to the group.
And what, you know, most of the time, it's all brand new to the group that you're workshopping with, which is also like, it's new to them. They've never done it before. But I found myself, I lose the enthusiasm and energy because I realize I sound like a broken record. Like, it's not exciting for me to, you know, again, go through Susan Whelan's integrated model for group development, you know, again. But then it's like, okay, well, how can I facilitate that in a more interesting way? Like, instead of running through just some theory, can I do it through a different type of gamification? So with the truth or dare, I mean, that's a whole format that I'm now playing around with in terms of delivering content.
Can you share an example?
Well, I am, I'm going to be talking on stage in Stockholm in November at the Stockholm Experience Conference. And spoiler alert, I'm hoping to do a live truth or dare on stage. I don't know how it's going to work yet. Maybe I can get some help. But the idea is that to just, again, shake things up a bit and, you know, you can learn about, in this case, it's Dare to Collaborate. So I'm thinking of, you know, bringing up a couple of facilitators on stage and daring them to do some sort of collaborative activity with the audience or something. We'll see. But that's one way. And then I'm also very much looking at, so the truth part is sort of rooted in theory, but also sort of experience-based reflection. So it's like, you know, you as a facilitator, open questions, you know, like in the game, you know, you get a difficult question that you need to answer. Whereas the dare part is more of sort of facilitation activities or sort of introspective challenge to sort of look at my own being as a facilitator. So I'm playing around with that to see, is that a format that can be used for workshops, for interactive talks? Like, how can that sort of be fun, and for how long, until I do something new?
Yeah, what I like about that is it brings back childhood memories that are a combination of discomfort, maybe a smirk, maybe a little bit of shame.
And actually, the idea came about because, she'll kill me for telling you all this, but she won't listen to this podcast because she's 7. My brother's daughter came home from school and she had had her first kiss. So we were interrogating her what had happened, you know, like, in what context did you kiss your boyfriend? And she said, in a quite a sassy way, she said, "Well, Jenny, we were just playing dare or dare." I was like, okay, so you're setting this up for success? Yep. So she had that all planned out, and I just really liked that concept. It's just like, not even going to bother with the truth. We're just going to go straight for the money and the smooch.
I want to be kissed tonight, so I designed the context.
Yeah,
I'm going to play. A facilitator.
Exactly.
Slightly manipulative, maybe.
Slightly. But I do thank her for it in the book. It was very inspirational.
Yeah. And I wonder why it is that many facilitators don't dare. Or dare in the sense that you're describing, or that we're discussing, of daring to do something new. Because I sense that many stick to the good old, the proven, just because they expect the clients to want that, or they don't want to take any risks. Because from the podcast, I know how many ideas facilitators have. It's a very creative group of people.
I think it comes down to any practice, you need to innovate to stay relevant. I mean, even these proven methods and theories change. And unless you're on top of that, it will date quite quickly. But then also, you know, it's the sense of feeling safe and, you know, psychological safety as well. And what type of clients that you have. Like I shared just the other week on LinkedIn, not, you know, I'm open for new projects, but I'm looking for daring clients. You know, you need to be like this for me to work with you. So I think if you can set some ground rules in terms of how you can influence the environment of which you'll be working in, you'll probably be more creative.
That's a very good point. And maybe that's where it all starts to go wrong, that many facilitators don't create, and that's what I hear a lot, don't create the context or don't, are not clear whom they want to serve. Yeah. So the jack of all trades.
Exactly. So, you know, I find myself very, very lucky when I have clients who are, you know, all for fun and games, as well as, you know, making sure that this is relevant for the business goals or, you know, whatever else is in the brief, but they're not afraid to let their hair down a little bit and have some fun in the process, because why else, you know, do we do it? Work in general. So I think that when you find those, I see my clients as part of my team just as much as when I invite in a co-facilitator. Like, we're a team, we're working on this together. And most of the time, their input and their feedback just makes my work better, because they're the ones who know the audience, who know the client. You know, we just kind of swoop in hoping that it is as sort of learner-centric as we can make it, and not be afraid of, you know, pushing each other as well. Yeah. Whereas, you know, back in the day when I worked at agency, you know, it was the whole customer's always right mentality. And even though we might have been pushing them with creative ideas, like in the campaigns and stuff, the process wasn't particularly challenging. It was just like, oh, we'll just do one of those campaigns that we did for so-and-so, but we changed the branding and some, you know, it'll be fine.
That's very interesting perspective. So that you basically, now you're facilitating the process in the collaboration in order to get to the more interesting, innovative ideas that you can then implement with them.
Yes. And when my clients work with me, it's quite interesting how at a certain point they realize that that is a learning journey as well. And that they learn from me, like in how to do this, because, and it also goes against, you know, sort of all business models of me going like, I want to become redundant as soon as possible. Like, I want you to be able to do all this shit yourself. Because, that, you know, most of the time it's like, oh, you need me to come back. Oh, you have more issues. You know, it's like, I want them to feel empowered and confident that they can bring in facilitation internally, because that's what I'm like trying. My mission is really trying to get the facilitation skills within to bloom, and that they don't have to rely on someone coming in and doing it for them. They're too scared. Like, they don't have the creative power to sort of to do what we do, maybe. And I kind of want to give that to them in the process.
And there we are again. So they're too scared. So they're too scared to facilitate. So they need to dare to facilitate.
Boom.
And I can see that, because I think a good facilitator pokes the group, pokes the client, is a little bit of stubborn, because otherwise they wouldn't need us if we'd just agree. And still somehow it feels scary.
I think so. I mean, I'm assuming so. So I toggle in the land of learning L&D and learning experience, and then also sort of just creative facilitation, workshop sprints, and so forth. I mean, learning is the red thread. I think it's scary because maybe it's the perspective. Maybe, this is just a random thought. maybe the chief learning officer or sort of a senior L&D specialist should be a consultant. I'm just thinking the opposite, should be a consultant to shake things up.
Because they don't have the risk to be fired.
Because as we know, working with learning, it takes time to learn, you know. In the instance with Hyper Island, I'm so happy that I had a whole year with them, because if it was just 3 months, they would probably have left in that state of anxiety, which I received in that letter. I don't know, maybe it would have been like that. But I don't know, maybe this sort of outside perspective and also our diverse perspective of working with a lot of different type of businesses is needed. If it's too much of an internal role, maybe that person or that department, they don't get enough of perspective to dare to do a good job.
Yeah. And
I don't know.
I'm thinking of something extremely different, but maybe still related, of couples living together or living apart. So I believe that it's the most romantic thing to live apart for my partner, because every time we decide to meet, it is a decision. It's not that we're spending time because we are forced to. So, and having separate lives and then coming together, we always bring this kind of new inspiration in. So with the consultant, if they're not inside the company, they might have other clients as well that they bring in. And if they're working there, it's because it's a decision from both sides.
It could be, you know, like we're all different, you know, and I see in Sweden, there's a lot of people who've been in the same company for a long time. But I've also noticed that, you know, there's a lot of focus on reskilling at the moment and upskilling to keep them in and, you know, for them to learn, which I find great. You know, if you find an organization where you can thrive and develop and change, you know, why not stay there for 10 years, 15 years?
An experiment. Yeah.
But I think facilitation it's so interesting because that's a skill relevant to so many jobs.
Yes.
Right? It's not just one.
Yeah. And I think there's a facilitator with a capital F. And then there are those who facilitate.
Exactly.
And there are many who don't facilitate enough. I'm thinking of all these team leaders, managers who've never learned to facilitate and might not even be aware that it's a skill to acquire.
And even looking at sort of parallel skills like creative thinking, for example, you know, like I think it's John Cleese who says, you know, it's not a talent, it's a skill. Like you can learn this. It's not that scary. It's not something that you're just innately good at. You can learn it. And I think the same thing with facilitation. Like some people are genuinely natural at leading people, but there's a lot of middle managers and leaders who aren't.
Yeah. And in all of that, it sounds as if there are two parts to the dare to facilitate. There's a part that is, okay, I dare to actually impose or invite a group to adopt a certain structure. And I think it is quite daring, especially for a manager to say, hey, guys, this time we'll start with a check-in. Everyone says something before we come to the agenda. I think the very first time it is scary because it's new and everyone fears of being laughed at, which might even happen. So there's this part of daring to do. And then there's also the daring to be part where it's standing in the conflict, being a bit outside of the group in order to manage dynamics.
That's where, so I'm working on some facilitative leadership masterclasses. And in order to sort of bridge that gap, I am connecting the sort of skills on the rise based on the World Economics Forum's predictions of 2026. And you as a facilitative leader supporting and helping your team reach those. So you kind of distance yourself from it's me improving, you know, as I need to become something, and more of, oh, I can use these ways and these techniques to help them, you know, reach these. And at the same time, I am as well, because I'm facilitating something around creative thinking, which also makes me better at creative thinking. So I think you can look at it from more of us, you know, who are they serving with their facilitation, and maybe removing a little bit of that scary feeling of I need to take a new role, or I need to act like in a certain way, because as soon as they start doing it, they will become empowered. I mean, we know that, you know, after you've had a series of sessions around something and you see like the sparkle in the eyes of the people who now are, you know, oh, we love this stuff. You're like, yeah, it's all going great. I'm the best.
Yeah, the impact of a group feeling heard and seen. And exactly. Communicating in a very respectful way with each other, because they know that the space is held and safe. They cannot go back.
But I think also there's a lack of, and this is something that I work with my clients quite a bit, looking at sort of the self-driven development and the informal side of learning. You know, like if you want to embrace and embody being a facilitated leader, you probably need to set some goals. You know, you probably need to actually have a master plan, a map, a roadmap to, you know, how, because how are you going to measure your improvement if it's not a course where you get like a certificate? You need to measure your progress to know how it's going. I was joking with a client the other day, because maybe you've seen this somewhere. I've never seen this anywhere. All these companies who try now and like build a learning culture by providing informal learning, training and inspiration. I've never seen anyone have like an alumni community of self-learners. You know, like it's always like everyone is taking a leadership course, or everyone is taking a project management course. They're an alumni by doing that. But what about everyone who's learning on their own? Do you know what I mean? I think that, you know, it's kind of fun. Like if let's say like you set your own curriculum of like, I'm going to learn this skill and I'm going to do it by watching these videos, write a reflection on this, do that and the other. And then, you know, you show that to your manager or your boss, and you have to pitch that you've met your learning goals. Boom, you're in the alumni for informal learners.
And then I think the issue there is that you will never become an alumni. Because I think if once you're in this mindset of informal continuous learning, you're done. So it's rather a community of self-paced informal learners.
Yeah, or it could just be an alumni of your milestones.
Yeah, yeah.
I just think like if they're going to be pushing this, and also the reskilling and, you know, working with keeping and retaining their employees, and only have, you know, emphasis on creating sort of alumni for the big programs, I think there's a lot of people sort of left behind.
Yeah. And I think it's, what is the purpose of such an alumni group? It's maybe for networking. Maybe they're sharing good old days. But I think what is more important is to keep the practice alive. So what I have worked on with a client, where I have built a in-house facilitation academy, which is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And now it runs totally without me. And the graduates of the first cohorts are now teaching the new cohorts. So it's perfectly self-sustainable. And the last bit that we did was, an alumni group, where now they can also support each other in finding workshops that they can facilitate in order to keep the practice. And then there's this entire gamification around it where they earn badges, and these kind of things. But at least there is an incentive of...
Yeah, there's a continuation to the... And also, you know, reinforcing exactly what you said, like this is a lifelong, you know, process. But I think one of the major benefits I've seen with alumni communities, at least my own, you know, from all my classes and programs and internally as well, is that if they commit, the whole sort of discipline and accountability stays. And I've seen it in some instances where, you know, previous students meet regularly and coach each other, or, you know, form some sort of accountability bond, which I find great. But then also there's the sort of the knowledge sharing, the kind of what happened afterwards, like how much of the learnings are you actually practicing, and can you dare to, you know, test more things that you learned? So it was just a flying thought of all those who are sitting at home doing all these LinkedIn learning, you know, courses, and they should belong as well.
Yes, they need a community.
They need a community too.
And then we talked about community building in our exploration call and how much facilitation it takes. And because just bringing a group of people together who share the same interest or who graduated from the same course or have the same mindset isn't enough.
No, it's extremely challenging. I have my community design education, which, you know, hands up in the air, I have checked out from pretty much, and have a friend of mine who's very disciplined in keeping that alive. And she really is. Tash Wilcox, hats off to you. But yeah, there needs to be, I mean, it's the reason why the community experts exist. And I'm really good at bringing people together around a common cause. But it deserves someone with more of a business model brain as well, because, I mean, there's so many communities, free communities out there who are just like, you join for a bit and then it just becomes another Slack graveyard. Yes. Because they don't have a business model or they don't have someone who is dedicated to facilitate and moderate it. So,
yeah. Yeah. I would like to come back to the daring of the facilitation. If someone believes that their facilitation could use a little bit of a dare, but they don't know where to start. And I'm thinking of someone who looks in the mirror like, yeah, I'm guilty. I'm always doing the same thing. And sometimes I'm a bit bored by what I'm doing. What's the tiny little step? What's the micro step to get out of this routine and to do a little dare to then find the confidence to dare more next time?
Play the game. Ask someone to dare you, someone you trust, maybe. Accountability. You know, like when I feel stuck, I reach out to either Tash, who I just mentioned, or Yorick, who I've done lots of work with. And she's like, I want to do this differently. Like, how would you do it? Or even ask someone who's not a facilitator, like someone who's maybe been in a whole lot of workshops, or someone who, like, let's say you're facilitating a design sprint, like speak to a designer or a product owner or someone who's like within that world. That's what I would do, kind of just reach out. Otherwise, it's just going through our wonderful, you know, toolboxes online and looking at just different ways of doing things. I started a website called Toolbox for that, sort of that purpose. And in fact, every time you go into it, and it is a toolbox of toolboxes, hence the name. And when you go into it, the list is refreshed every time. So you'll see a new one pop up at the top, because I also wanted to create that rabbit hole, having worked at Hyper Island for 3 years using the Hyper Island toolbox over and over again. It's like, oh God, there must be more out there. And obviously there are. So I started listening to them and looking at them from loads of different perspectives.
Yeah, good one. And then what pops in my mind is activities we have done at the Never Done Before community a couple of times, I think initially inspired by Jakob Cromie, and where everyone brought their favorite tool or activity and then matching with someone else and then see, okay, what if we merge these two activities, what comes up? So we had the five hats troika, for instance. Which is a beautiful activity, or the Ored Troika, and sometimes becoming even better than the original ones.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, you know, doing innovation mashups, but on our own content, not on somebody else's content. So I think that's, you know, that's a great one. With the toolbox, I've actually used that website in sessions, like sort of discovery sessions where I've asked the students, do they have a certain amount of time to go through the website? And then each one picks one of the, like, a tool or a activity or a whole toolbox. I mean, they can decide. Create a presentation, and then in groups decide, okay, which one do we want to present in groups? And then they all present them. And that's really interesting from a data perspective, because what I noticed in one of those instances Willy Kosovich Comedy for Companies Toolbox. So it's he runs a business where he basically, it's comedy for companies. Like, how can you use comedy for business? And he's got a they call it a tool sack. So it sounds funnier. And that was like the top. So it's like, you just don't know like where the enthusiasm lies unless, you know, the power of the collective. It's quite a nice way to, you know, mash things up, try things out, showcase, you know, I love this. Have you seen this? And just knowledge share to get the best out of it.
Yeah. And what comes also to my mind, I love the idea, by the way, to just ask the students to go through the tools and then it's a nice way also to just, explore, take time to explore. I think even for experienced facilitators would be nice from time to time.
And this was for a course I ran in process design. So it was very much, you know, shake things up.
Yeah.
Do it differently. You don't have to follow, you know, step 1, 2, 3, 4. You can decide your own process.
Yes. Yeah. I think the liberty that we can give ourselves permission, that's beautiful. And I think that's an underestimated superpower we have as facilitators. And what I also realized that sometimes just discussing the flow or activities with the client, and if the client have no idea of facilitation, they sometimes ask questions or they come up with ideas that you wouldn't find in any facilitation book because they don't know. But then like, exactly. Oh, yeah, that's a nice variation.
That can absolutely work. And I think, you know, there's a lot of, again, you know, looking at you being able to choose your clients, choosing the ones where you feel that trust, because I've been in positions where it's the exact opposite. You know, they're so nervous because they don't understand and they don't know. So in those instances, I've actually done what I normally don't do and show them the whole like minute by minute design, and very often they don't go through it. They're just like, okay, you know what you're doing.
Yes.
This is what I'm doing. That's my strategy with those types of clients. Whereas the other ones, you know, I just give them like 5 bullet points. You know, this is, these are the topics. These are my desired outcomes. Let's go. But yeah, you have to sort of navigate whoever it is who's sort of ordering this from you.
Yes, I can relate to that. And I had a client recently and they had some background in facilitation, and this is sometimes the most dangerous ones because they have a clear idea of how it should look like because that's what they know. And then they want the same. And then I come in where I'm like, okay, I do things differently. And then similar, I would then meet them where they are and explain why I'm doing things differently and why I'm choosing this specific flow and really walk them through the flow. Not with what we're doing, but why we're doing it. And usually this works like a charm.
Because, you know, there is actually no point in showing them, you know, the big running sheets, really. Like I do say this, like if I do show someone because I just need them to relax, I tend to say, this is like you reading through, you know, the end credits to a Marvel movie that you've not watched. There's really no point.
Yes.
Right. So I think like if you can focus on the trailer being ace, you got them hooked. Like you shouldn't have to show them, you know, credits in the beginning. But yeah, it's fascinating but I think that marks a good facilitator, like knowing how much or how little to share of the process.
Yeah. And giving them the heads up that even if they saw the minute by minute agenda, it might change totally the minute you step into the room.
Yeah, exactly. And that's also an interesting topic because, you know, daring to do things differently, like most sort of event producers, some like big event, like the big event producers, you know, they have these running sheets as well. And it's minute by minute. But, you know, your standard worker bee going to meetings and maybe a conference, you know, nothing is designed to that extent. So when I come in and just be like, okay, I've done, you know, like a minute by minute of these 3 days, they're just like, what? It's like, well, yeah, the more I put into this now, the more I can change everything when we're standing there. The more we put into this now, we see, you know, we've covered everything that you need to cover. And the more we understand what we're doing, the more flex and the more spontaneous we can shake things up, you know, tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Yeah.
What makes a workshop fail?
What makes a workshop fail? It's really difficult because I work with learning, and a lot of the collaborators I've worked with, like institutions and schools, they work with having some sort of survey review at the end, and they all want it to be 5 out of 5, and they all want it to, you know, to be the best possible experience. And when we have that conversation, I say, well, actually, I am aiming for a 3.5 because I want it to hurt a little bit. Like, learning is messy. It's difficult. It's not like just going to this thing and to be entertained for 2 hours where you really enjoyed, you know, the facilitator's jokes and her shoes. I want you to walk away feeling challenged, feeling like you maybe have this new idea in your head that's scary but exciting, like all these other things. So for me, a workshop has failed if they're all too happy and it's a 5 out of 5, right? I think that's my spontaneous answer.
Intriguing. And what comes to my mind is there are different levels of discomfort. So, and I hear the discomfort of learning and maybe the feeling the growth pain or anticipating the growth pain.
Yes.
Which can be extremely uncomfortable. And yes, I can see trainings where this is triggered, where I will only see how helpful it was maybe a week or two afterwards.
Or a year. Students quite recently, a year after he graduated, and he said, Jenny, I just want to let you know how much I appreciate you now.
I didn't back then.
He went, yeah, well, all I wanted to do was, you know, design cool apps when I was studying, and you were, you know, having us do value proposition and business modeling and like innovation processes, and I didn't understand how that connected to what I wanted to, you know, learn. But now, as a product owner, I don't understand how any business would thrive without these things. And I couldn't design any type of product without, you know, knowing its value proposition. And you knew that.
How did you?
My job to know that at the time. So I think, you know, especially with learning experiences, the receipt of you doing of a job well done. Don't expect that to land straight away after your session.
Yes.
Expect a week later, a year later, 5 years later.
I love the bit that obviously as a trainer, you know, you can anticipate what they will need to know in the future that they cannot even see just yet.
Yes.
And yeah, this might or will cause frustration, especially to the excited, ambitious learners who want to know it all, who want to have, they want the 5 out of 5.
To be honest, they're the ones who tend to grow the most.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's the ones who were slightly annoying to me, like on a personal level, who are the ones that I have most contact with post, because they still want to talk about it. You know, they still want to learn about it. And the other fascinating, and I think it also comes down to the content of what you're doing, because I've been running programs and courses in, you know, digitalization and digital transformation and innovation and business development and things that are really new, you know. So there's the fear or the, you know, the tech illiteracy or the not understanding of that comes into play as well. So I had a student on the MA at Hyper Island, which was in digital management, come to me and say, I'm finding it really difficult to underpin what I'm saying academically, like finding research that connects to what I'm saying. I'm finding it really, really difficult. And I think it was something to do with eye tracking. I can't remember what it was. And then I just reminded that student, like, well, you're doing an MA. You're the research. Go out and test it. Get a peer review. Like, you do the research. Like, you do it. You be the research. And they're like, oh, yeah. So it wasn't like I have to get someone else to prove my point. I can go prove it myself. That also comes into play whether a workshop or a like whatever session is successful or not. It lies in the content as well.
And in the mindset that as a facilitator, you come in and you believe that the group has what it needs. to get what it needs. So this, yes, you're, as a trainer, you come in to bridge a knowledge gap, but also you believe in the, that the group can find it out and that they have wisdom and they, their collective intelligence can help them to find solutions. And I think this empowerment of the individual, that's also facilitation superpower.
Absolutely, 100%. Mm. If you want them to learn something, I think by empowering them in their own learning journey, by, you know, pushing and inspiring them to think creatively and being curious is just as important as, you know, going through the motions of whatever workshop that you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, most of my activities, they're there to help and lead the learning taking place. So again, it comes back to how do you evaluate a successful workshop? Are you evaluating that the process went well? Like, I am so happy if I, you know, end exactly the time that I'm supposed to end. That's like euphoria for me. But, you know, they don't care. Like, they wouldn't care if it was 2 minutes over. I would care, but they wouldn't care. So I don't, like, I think for me, I would probably be happy or see it as successful if I end on time.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, and I think they do care. Maybe students are a little, they give you a little bit more slack, but in companies, yeah, they appreciate if you start on time and finish on time.
They do. And I have experienced when they do not appreciate ending early. Interesting. Yeah, I did a boot camp. And I think, you know, for us, it was all based on the desired learning outcomes. And you never know how fast or slow a group can move. And I think we ended an hour early. And this was part of a 2-day, you know, boot camp. We ended an hour early and the client was furious. You know, they're like, this is supposed to be a boot camp. You know, we're supposed to be like working, you know, into the early hours, like that kind of mentality. So it's like you're robbing us of an hour of time in a way. And we're just like, what? It's like for us, it went really well. Like your group is fantastic. Like there were no snags. Like everything worked as it should. And to be honest, like often we put in extra time for those snags to happen. Yeah. So, I, you know, expectations in the beginning of what feeling do you want to leave after this workshop? Is it, you know, sweaty and stressed and or do you want to leave feeling that you've accomplished something within the time that we have allocated? But yeah, that's, again, thanks for the win.
And then this brings me back to the idea of, do we aim for 5 out of 5 or 3.5? And then I think there can be evaluate, you don't want to end up at a 3.5 because it was messy in the design or the group didn't feel safe or it was just slightly off everything you did.
That's a major difference. Yeah.
I think there is, you want to be very skilled in holding the space in the basic facilitation skills so that you can lose a few points by just throwing out them out of their comfort zone.
Yeah.
To the growth zone.
Yeah, totally agree. And then also, it also comes down to, I mean, it's a massive trigger for me, just the word survey, because I work with feed forward and I work with, you know, working with the group in improving stuff and the amount of, you know, conversations that I've had with, like for me and for our sanity, having a 1 out of 5 stars and it's saying like good, not good. What does that mean? Like, what does good mean? You know, good means different to different people. Like, it's completely pointless. So I have managed to like at least go so far to changing the terminology a little bit, like whether it's like relevant or not relevant or, you know, but that really frustrates me that it's not, for me, it's not vanity metrics. It's about the quality in those numbers, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And what is the one thing that they're taking away? What is it that they can implement right away? Was it a useful use of their time?
Exactly. Exactly. Those are so much more valuable than between 1 to 5. How's the food? You know, like I was there, you know, yeah, the food was great. we know, you know, like it's not something that actually supports or helps this going forward that much.
Yeah. So, although I think, if the food sucks, it can destroy an entire workshop.
It can.
There's not enough.
But I think, you know, I think a lot of the stuff we're aware of. So like when it comes down to having any kind of evaluation, like for me, like really all that I want to know is what are the things that were really great and what are the things that can become even better?
Mm.
Focus on those two things. Like, yes, the food wasn't great, but maybe someone writes, you know, it was a fantastic, amazing session. Like everything was really, really great. However, we had cabbage for lunch and, you know, my friends around the table were farting all the time. So maybe improve the lunch. I think it's more like how that's set up in the evaluation rather than like one to five.
Yeah.
Because that we can understand and empathize with, because there's a reason.
And I think this is, isn't facilitation all about the purpose? And then the question is, what is the purpose of a survey? Is it to put a 5 out of 5 on my website and say, hey, I always get the best evaluation? Or is a survey for me to introspect? What should I continue doing? And what might want to change for the learners?
Like, and I have this conversation all the time, you know, with some of the schools, they have an obligation to the Swedish government to give evaluations on their programs and courses, like for vocational schools, you know, they need to send in to be able to keep that education. Corporate side, you know, it, all sorts of things, political, you know, like prove something that, you know, we need this program and look how many people loved it. Whereas, you know, for me, if I'm in the room or if I have booked someone else in the room, we tend to have a different, like a separate evaluation, because, you know, our purposes very rarely align with the organization's purpose of that evaluation. So even though, like, I do very much like to try and dare them to think of it more as an iterative process, that they need to be agile, that they need to like use this is a tool, this evaluation, it's not just vanity metrics and going, hey, look, we done, this is great. But then at the same time, often it's like, is it okay if I do my own? It's like, yeah, sure, fine.
Yeah.
So as with anything, you on the money with that, the purpose is the key, and that it could be very different. But the issue is that the people in the workshop, they need to know the purpose as well to write it properly. Hence, when I've had the chance to educate those learners in giving feedback or feed forward, it makes such a difference to the ones who are just used to TripAdvisor, you know, the ones that are just used to critiquing stuff because they've been in a learning experience. They don't work with feedback in their team, you know. I think it comes to the maturity of the attendees as well.
Yes, very true. Very true.
Interesting, though, because we want it to go well, right? And also, you know, workshop fail. Like when anyone, you know, starts talking about failing fast, I'm like, learn fast.
Mm.
You know, failing here, that's not what we're doing. We're learning. So I would try and see the learning if I walked out feeling disappointed in the outcome of a session.
Yeah.
I have been there. Like when you just feel the disappointment for some reason, you don't know why, but yeah, you notice when they don't call you to do a new job.
Yeah.
Or they couldn't handle me. Right.
You know, just this, the atmosphere in the space that feels drained of all energy, where suddenly nobody is smiling and everyone is just wants it to be over. Okay, bye.
Because some of this stuff is hard. Like if you're facilitating, I don't know, you're facilitating like some big corporate vision, OKR, you know, session, like the brain power necessary from the participants, you know, is a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just all fun and games. It's hard and it's difficult. And I think our job is to try and make that process as, you know, fulfilling as possible and working with the energy in the room.
Yeah. And I think then using the facilitation skills to break it down into small chunks and having small wins, because it drains our energy if it was too hard of a push. But then if we know that we can design these small activities and each activity feeds into the next and at the end. So that's my goal, that at the end, they have the impression, oh, how did we get there? That was easy. I didn't see that coming.
Or even just having the intuition of removing something.
Yes.
Like, this would have been so much fun. But, you know, within the context of how today is going, let's not do that. Let's do this instead.
Yeah.
Let's do something more light instead.
That's daring to facilitate.
Exactly.
To change the plan because you trust your intuition.
Exactly. I was speaking to one of my contributors in the book, his name is Patrick, and he's got the chapter on improvisation.
Mm.
And he was talking about a session that he ran in the jungle, and they were in there, and he knew, like, there's a lot of stress in his group, and they were out in nature, and he just, like, out of nowhere, he's just like, we're just going to stop here, be silent for like 10 minutes. All I want you to do is try and to listen to a bird sound you've never heard before. And they did that. And then, okay, I'm going to give you another 5 minutes. And now I want you, and you know, it sounds a bit like hippie-ish, but I think, you know, when you were there, it would have been amazing. And he said, now I want you to listen to yourself.
Mm.
And just that, I'm getting goosebumps. And just that improvisation, that's a facilitation skill.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think these hippie, it's interesting that you call it hippie. Yeah, I would call it woo-woo. Yes, it might feel and sound like that. And in some circumstances, you can do it, and in others, not. And again, in others, you're surprised that you can do it.
Yeah.
And I think especially when it comes to these corporate settings, very serious, if in these settings we dare to be just a little bit more woo-woo, just a little bit more spiritual, emotional, vulnerable, pays off.
Another chapter I have in the book is called Dare to Notice.
Mm.
You know, just like trying little things just to notice your surroundings, or notice how you're feeling, or notice, like, instead of having that meeting like we always do in the same meeting room, let's go outside.
Mm.
Like, it's the smallest thing that people just don't do enough. And I think you need to have that sort of creativity and the willpower just to be like, let's just go, let's just try. And you will see a remarkable difference, I think, when you just do those. And it can be the smallest of things.
Yeah.
Because people still seem to not know how to have meetings in, you know, corporate Sweden, at least.
Because everyone is so busy hiding behind their mask or answering emails being in the meeting.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, no, it's true. And again, like, going back to the facilitator with the small F and the big F, you know, I've found myself in positions where I've attended meetings not being the facilitator, and there isn't a facilitator, and me going like, should I put myself forward? It's not my job, and there's a lot more work to do it. Like, then I would really have to, like, cancel this meeting, you know, look at the intention and the outcomes and design an agenda and, like, do it properly. And that comes with a lot more work. So I understand those who have the skills, but they're not being empowered through them.
Yeah.
And they just see it as extra work, not thinking how it impacts productivity.
Especially if it's not appreciated. And then it comes back to dare to facilitate.
Everything comes back to dare to facilitate.
Of course. And with all this daring to facilitate, what remains your number one facilitation challenge?
What? Sorry, say that again?
What remains your facilitation challenge?
What remains my facilitation challenge? I think one of the biggest things is actually that I'm in Sweden. I am Swedish, but I'm also very not Swedish in terms of, I'm usually very colorful. There's a lot of sort of a creative halo. And I'm quite, like, I'm very extroverted and outgoing. And a lot of Swedes, especially in sort of the corporate world, aren't. So there is a little bit of a culture difference. So I think one of my biggest challenges is as a facilitator to know, like, when do I level up? When do I bring it down? When do I wear just black clothes and maybe a little necklace, a big necklace? And when do I, like, some go, you know, all out? So I think that is my biggest challenge, to kind of more looking at my being and seeing how I make this work. Because, you know, when I left agency world, you know, I promised myself something, that I'm never going to take a job or a project where I'm not allowed to wear the shoes I want to wear. Mm. Like, that's like, I need to be able to wear my colorful sneakers to everything. Like, that was my rule. So, you know, I think that's my biggest challenge, I think.
Thank you. Yeah. And it's an interesting challenge, because I think that so much of our work and the impact we can have is directly related to how comfortable we feel to be ourselves.
Yeah. And I think my challenge is I'm a little bit too comfortable in myself sometimes. So it's, you know, I can come across as like the wild card. I noticed that quite quickly when I came to Sweden, that because I started applying for jobs just to see like what the market was like. And I noticed very, very quickly that I did get the interviews, but I was the wild card. I was the one that they didn't really understand, because I had a CV from London with agency names no one had heard of. They heard of the clients, huge clients, which is like, oh, sexy. But, you know, the agencies were just not very well known. And then I came with my business, which was an experiential business looking at like creative events. So I did loads of exhibitions and stuff. So I was like, oh, that looks like, oh, interesting. Ooh. But then, you know, you would see who the person was who got the job, and was often very much in the same mold as the people who already worked there. So I think like that's why I also like being a consultant, because I can stay true to myself, and I rather work with fewer clients where we match culturally and we can then, you know, collaborate and create great, great, great stuff, than being forced to run workshops for, you know, business who values I don't believe in, or they're actually not very nice people, or whatever else. So,
yeah, I can relate to your story. So I was very often not even invited to the interviews, because I didn't fit in any of these HR boxes. And very quickly realized that I was unemployable, coming out of higher education, having been the strategic advisor to the university president, where people, I think, just thought that I was making this up, because I was way too young for that. And now see that it is this 100% feeling comfortable of being ourselves that then gives permission to the groups to 100% be themselves. So I don't believe that you can be too much of yourself. Maybe you can be with the wrong client. Yeah. And then even a little bit of yourself is maybe too much. Mm. But I think if it's a match, then if you feel so comfortable that you can just be the authentic you, the energy it creates in the group, because everyone knows, oh, I can be myself too. And I realized that actually recently that it's part of my, let's call it signature, that I'm very well prepared and I plan my workshops to the minute, and still there's always something slightly imperfect.
Yeah.
It's like, we'll be good enough. So I'm unapologetically good enough, although my good enough is, I think, a very high standard. And I realized it was with this attitude of, oh, oops, forgot that. It creates this ease in the group that they also don't have to be perfect, and that good enough and being themselves is just good enough.
I mean, being vulnerable around it. I mean, for me, I had a reflection just the other day of, you know, my signature is high energy, lots of color, you know, props and engagement. But since COVID and becoming a mom, my energy is, you know, it's not at the level it was. I've been sick a lot. So that's also quite difficult. Like if you do have this brand and then you realize like, I can probably not live up to that to the same degree. What do I do then? So now like another challenge for me is to do fewer, but with bigger impact and not because like you, I plan everything. Like I love the tailor-made. I could not, you know, design one thing and then just run that over and over and over again. So I do put like all my energy and heart and soul into that session, whatever it is. So I just need to make sure that whatever that is, I get enough paid. Right?
Yes. Yes, totally.
But yeah, we all have challenges in life.
Luckily, otherwise it would be boring.
I know. It's a lifelong learning journey.
Yeah. I realized that recently when I had a difficult client, it really cost me energy and made me angry. And then there was this moment of the switch where I'm like, oh, wait a moment. It's actually nice to have this little challenge and to rethink everything, how I do it. And then we ended up being best friends. And it was, yeah, it was just the chat. Yeah. This person dared me.
Yeah.
And I put them in the difficult box instead of thinking, what if they were right? And then I realized, oh, if it's just all too easy, it's boring. And
that's what's awesome about neuroplasticity is that like your brain changes based on your experiences. Like it physically changes. Mm. So I find that too. Like if we truly want to work with, you know, diversity, you need to lean in because most of the time you're taking offense putting this person in a difficult box because you're just not agreeing with them. And it's like, well, why am I not agreeing with them? Like, what is my unconscious bias in not agreeing with them? And so as soon as you sort of break that down and lean in to what they're really, what they're trying to say, you will grow.
Yeah. Our unconscious biases. And it's so easy to become stubborn about, oh, but I'm the facilitator. I know how this works.
Two lines there. Like at certain points, I'm just like, just shut up. I know what I'm doing. And then on the other side, it's kind of like, shut up. I don't know what I'm doing, but I'll fix it. Like, you know, it's like, I'm not the expert. I need to talk to people who, you know, who've done what I'm doing for the first time. They've done it 30 times. Because you do get it, but you know, that's when I think about stuff too long. So you just have to go and do it and just see how it lands. Like with this book, like the longer it sits, not being finally printed, the more I'm questioning every single thing. Mm-hmm.
Which is so human. Right? Because then suddenly we make problems out of stuff that's not even a problem. It's just we have too much time to think about it.
Exactly. Like doing a find and replace on every time I use the word embrace and change it with some synonyms. There was too many of them.
You know? Can you use the word embrace too often? No, it's such a beautiful word.
But me. But, you know, but it's also that joy, you know, like when you're going into a workshop and you have that hour prior and you have the opportunity to tweak something.
Mm.
I still see the magic in that because then, you know, you've spent so much time doing this thing. It's pretty much there. And you look at the agenda, you look at the design of everything. You're like, do you know what? I'm just going to switch those two things. Yes. I think it'll become better. I want that experience first and then the reflection or whatever. And then you have to go with it. You know, that there's a beauty in that.
Totally. And I think it's because it's, again, related to who we are and what our authenticity is. Sometimes it feels right in the moment, or you step into the space, you see the participants and you're like, need to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this, it doesn't fit. And then and then the last minute changes can be beautiful.
Yes. And another reason why you should dare to do things you've never done before is when you are in that moment, you will have a Mary Poppins bag of these tools and things you've tried and tested that you can just whip out. You're like, okay, this thing didn't work for that client, you know, the first time we tried it, but it will work for this one.
Yes. And then still there's sometimes, and I think that's where it gets tricky, sometimes there are these moments where I want to hold back or I chicken out. Because so I have this kind of bold idea to dare the group. And then I stand there and I see the group and I, what would be the safe solution? And then I realize, okay, the moment that I do dare, and again, it has a beautiful impact on the group because they can sense that I trust them with that.
I have made a fool out of myself so many times, just being like, okay, I don't know if they're going to like follow me now, but I am hoping. But usually, like when that happens, like for example, at Hyper Island, there's an energizer called Go Bananas. And you basically, you start to dance and it's Go Bananas, Go Bananas, B-A-N-A-S. You know, it's like a chime. And then it just goes wilder and wilder and wilder. You're just supposed to go freaking bananas. And I go all the way. And then I've seen some like videos from those. You just feel like, yeah, they're not really with me, but I have fun. And afterwards, like, I mean, just because of that, I was really known as, you know, the bananas girl, but in a positive way. It's just like, yeah, she loves her energizers. So because she really loves them, let's do them too to make her happy.
I think as long as you really believe in it and you have fun, yeah. If you would do it, let's do it, bananas.
Then it would work.
No.
In most instances, it's all or nothing. It's a performance. Yeah. Same with like if you do ultimate rock, paper, scissors, or if, you know, these like big group challenges, you have to go all in and role model. I think otherwise there's no point if you're just like, go bananas.
That's like, why I would never do this bananas thing. And I am not an icebreaker girl.
Yeah.
It's just not me. I don't dance. I don't sing. I don't do these kind of.
But you have your ways. Of-
exactly. Exactly. And I do other things that feel daring to them and to me.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to stay true to ourselves.
Yes, this is also an extreme because that is the culture of Hyper Island. Like it's very much energizers and it's very much like morning raves and stuff. Those things don't work with my corporate clients. So I get, you know, you have to choose based on who you're working with. And also, you know, the whole like, I don't see them as icebreakers. I see them as energizers. And it's very often like I wouldn't do them with a group that I don't know. Apart from the Stockholm experience, I will do some kind of crazy thing there because they will need it. And they're hopefully all designers. So they'll be creatively minded.
Yes.
But, you know, you can still like, I've, you know, used a lot of Lego with corporate clients. And, you know, for them, that is so new and playful and energizing. So, yeah, you just use the tool that you find relevant.
Yeah.
What do you do to energize a group?
For me, it's less about the energizing, but about the landing in the group and with each other. So how can we create a space where we see each other as humans? So I always start with the turn to your neighbor moment.
Okay.
Why are you here? How do you relate to that? So how to get using vocal cords early and standing up doing that. So in my workshops, we rarely sit.
Good.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm more of the brainy, I think, facilitator.
And I'm more of the spaghetti and the marshmallows.
And it's great, I think, to just see the differences and how we do things. We might use the similar activities or work on similar projects, but from very different angles.
The same person I referenced in the beginning of our talk, my co-lead, Max, you know, because I had not worked at Hyper Island before, obviously, and I hadn't, you know, I'd never programmed an MA. It's a lot of new things for me. And I also never seen myself or defined myself facilitator, but I knew he was. And he was very much like you, like how you work from what I've understood with your explanation. And, you know, it took a while for me to be like, so that's a facilitator, right? So it wasn't until I met Tash, who was my other co-lead, who is one of the smallest people that I know with the biggest presence. I mean, she is like, the room is hers. And I was like, wow, you know, she is a completely different facilitator. So what kind of facilitator am I? And what are my strengths? And how can I build on those strengths? And that's where I was like, okay, my strengths, you know, creativity, design, high energy, engagement, blah, blah, blah. So that's what I'm going to do. But yeah, you're right. Like, there are so many different types of facilitators. And if you as a client, A, don't know really what facilitation is, how do you know who to work with?
And then I think, yeah, some resonate, some don't. And that's why it's so important to just show ourselves and be ourselves. And
yep.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when I worked with someone for the first time and I was doing an event with them and we were just friends before, like really good friends. And then we started to work together. And I remember him saying to me, like, Jenny, how come, like, you're all professional all of a sudden? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, with like proposals and like, and all, you know, the necessary documents you need and like being proper and doing, you know, the steps. I'm running a business, but he hadn't experienced that before. Mm. So that was, I remember that so clearly because I was like, but I'm just being me, but I'm running a business.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a professional part of it. But yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting perspective.
Yeah. And I love that you mentioned this because also for me, it's if I have this kind of professional organization and structure around it, then I can be just me and a little bit silly and a little bit good enough within that because I have shown I'm taking care of all the boundaries, all the context. Yeah. And then everything else will work out fine.
I need that to be on point. To have the freedom to create. And I think also that's how, for someone often misunderstood, I think that's one of the ways for me to build trust with my clients. Be like, I know what I'm doing and this is the process. So I think that really, really supports. And also like throughout the process, you know, if you have a good way of doing business and you have a good way of setting the contracts and the parameters of what you're doing, it shouldn't be a problem later on in the project.
Yes.
Which I have experienced when I've not set it up properly. You know, you think like, oh, we're just friends. Oh, well, then you don't need a contract. We'll just, you know, it's like, should have done the same way as I do with all of them.
And I have the impression that we could discuss until tomorrow. Could talk until tomorrow. I have another meeting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. This was really an interesting chat. I love diving into subjects from different perspectives and, you know, different ways, even though we are also so similar in our mindset and our vision of testing and daring and doing things we've never done before. But we also were different types of facilitators.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. We find something together, see how we would complement each other.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I would love to collaborate, find something.
All righty.
Thank you. And thank you. I'm looking forward to your book.
Mm-hmm. Out soon.
Yes. I put all the links in the show notes. It will be out when this comes out.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for staying tuned and for listening until the very end. I hope that you found the inspiration and the wisdom that you are looking for. And I hope that you will subscribe to the show so that you never miss any of the interviews with another inspiring facilitator from across the world. I'm devoted to continue this podcast and to deliver weekly an episode that maintains the quality that you expect and you deserve. And if you would like to help me to maintain this quality and to keep the podcast free, please help us. Visit workshops.org/support to make a small donation to keep the podcast free. Thank you so much. I hope to be in your ears next week.